Welcome to WCG Talks Trials, the podcast where we dive deep into the world of clinical research, sharing the latest trends, insights, and best practices from experts across the industry. In each episode of WCG Talks Trials, we'll explore a different area of the clinical trial industry while featuring a diverse range of clinical research and medical professionals. If you're passionate about advancing clinical research, improving patient outcomes, and driving healthcare forward, then WCG Talks Trials is the right podcast for you. We are so glad you could join us today.
Hello, I'm Leslie Ramsey, Director of Publications and Content at WCG. I'll be your host for today's WCG Talks Trials episode, the CRA's evolving role in a post-pandemic industry. Before we dive in, let me remind you to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on your favorite listening platforms like Apple Podcasts or Spotify, so you never miss an episode of WCG Talks Trial. Today, I'm excited to talk with a veteran CRA and CRA trainer, someone I've had the pleasure of working with on several books in the past few years, Elizabeth Weeks Rowe. A certified CRA, Elizabeth has been active in clinical research for more than 20 years as a study coordinator, CRA, CRA trainer, and CRA manager. She is the author of the CRA's Guide to Monitoring Clinical Research, now available in its sixth edition. Thanks for joining us, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me, Leslie. It's a pleasure to be here, and I've enjoyed very much working with you over the years as well. It kind of makes me laugh when you say for over 20 years, because now I'm officially that CRA.
Yeah.
I'm no longer the young one. I'm the dinosaur.
You qualify as a veteran now.
Oh.
Yes. Okay. Well, in today's talk, we're going to focus on the ways in which the role of the CRA has changed in recent years through a global pandemic, technology boom, a roller coaster job market, and more. As the conduit between sponsors, CROs, and study sites, CRAs are known as the glue that holds the trial together. I've even heard them called the unsung heroes of clinical trials. Elizabeth, how would you respond to such accolades?
You know, I would say that the CRAs are the frontline workers in the trenches. We have to be teachers, trainers. We have to, I don't want to say we're psychologists, but we're listening, we're empathizing, we're collaborating. The CRA job is extremely challenging. I don't want to say it's underappreciated, because I truly believe CRAs are appreciated, but in the thick of interim analysis, in the thick of trying to meet deadlines when you're hopping flights, sometimes working 15, 16 hour days, I don't think that it's fully appreciated how hard CRAs work, mm-hmm. but it's getting better. So I would definitely agree with the unsung hero.
Good. And good. Glad to hear that. Let's get started by discussing the impact of some new and developing areas on CRAs, beginning with decentralized trial methods, which obviously has been increasing since the pandemic and is continuing to increase in use. Decentralized trial methods are changing the way sites conduct trials and patients access them. How has decentralization impacted the role of the CRA? Positively, negatively, a mixture of both?
No, that's a great question. And as a sidebar, I'm waiting for the draft guidance to become final. I don't think it has yet, because that is going to definitely become a good read, the DCT FDA guidance. You know, decentralized clinical trials, I think it's a mixed bag as far as positive and challenging impact on the CRA role. I really don't want to say negative, because I don't want to say negative. I don't think it's negative. I think it's a learning curve, and I'll explain why. So obviously, when you are working with your site on identifying patients, recruiting, a positive on the CRA role with regard to working with sites is that when you're looking at a schedule of assessments, assessing a trial with a site, and then recruiting a trial, you're looking at visits and patient burden. So what's great for sites and CRAs who are working with sites to enroll patients are DCTs offer convenience for patients with the home visits, the local provider, community visits, testing. So that's great, because that can be a boon to help. Here's a trial, patient ease, enrollment, that can really help with enrollment. But that can also be a challenge, because you have home visits, you have vetted home health workers, either independent, vetted by the sponsor CRO, and visiting sites. So the first challenge can be, are these workers trained in clinical research and do they understand? So CRAs have to establish, evaluate, look at that. And then how do we confirm this? Are they on the delegation of authority log? Do we have the training? Then you have the gray area of PI oversight. PI oversight is not a gray area, but I've worked on studies where the question was, how does a PI maintain communication and oversight with home health workers or nurses visiting patients at home? There has to be good communication, or community providers who might be doing assessments under the DCT umbrella. So CRAs working with sites, establishing oversight, getting those communication lines, that can be challenging and it's part of the learning curve. I also was co-monitoring with a CRA on a study where patients were seen by home health nurses. And part of the learning curve there was, it was a newer CRA. She didn't understand that she really had to review the source notes for the home health visits. And I was going behind her looking, saying, did you look at this? Did you look at this? She was new. There was no fault. Again, part of that learning curve. The last thing I want to mention is sometimes selling DCT elements to sites as a CRA when you're discussing studies, evaluations, can be a little bit of a mixed bag. And this was something I encountered with site selection visits a couple of years ago, because you had some sites that were very experienced with elements of DCT. And when I say elements, I mean some studies offer a hybrid where they have on-site visits and home health or DCT visits. And in my experience, the hybrid has really been the most attractive. When you're talking to sites and you're saying, for example, home health visits, this agency is organized by the sponsor, the patients will be seen at home, blood draws, et cetera. Some sites are very reluctant because their organization doesn't have experience with this. They're not comfortable with using an outside agency for this. And so they don't want to have any home health visits on the study at all. As a CRA, that's challenging when you're trying to kind of discuss and sell. A positive is when you're dealing with sites who have done studies with home health visits, they're very open to it. They understand, they trust the process. And kind of a positive and a challenge is you have some sites, in my experience in the past, who are open to the DCT element home health, but they want their own coordinators to be doing the visits. And that opens up a whole other challenging mix. So there's been positives, negatives, challenges to it. But as it emerges, has more structure, once we get that final guidance, I think it's going to lend a lot of clarity and make it an easier assessment by the CRAs and facilitating monitoring, et cetera.
Elizabeth, you mentioned this draft guidance from the FDA on decentralized trials. That came out last May, and the comment period closed on it in August. And apparently, it did not do everything that the industry was hoping it would do. So it remains to be seen how the FDA is going to respond to those comments. What's your forecast on that?
I can only comment on what I have seen on LinkedIn as far as some site owners and their responses. This is not my personal opinion, because like I said, I'm going to hold that until the final guidance comes out, and then I'm going to read it in detail. But concerns about kind of some of the things that sites said to me were voiced by some site owners on LinkedIn about how do they ensure the training of community physicians, for example, who might be participating, making sure staff understand clinical research, training, that kind of stuff. Those are some of the things that I saw. Again, not speaking from an expert point of view at all, because I'm not, and I want to wait till the final guidance comes out.
Yeah. We haven't had any word yet on when that final guidance will come out, but when it does, I'm sure we will be reporting on it in CenterWatch Monthly and CenterWatch Weekly. Well, one of the decentralized methods that is becoming more and more used is remote monitoring. More and more CROs and sponsors are adopting remote monitoring procedures. What's your opinion of remote monitoring? Does it make the CRA's job easier or more difficult?
I think in a lot of ways, it's made the CRA's job easier. There are a lot of benefits. There are challenges as well. And I'll kind of speak to both if you're okay with that. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the benefits and things were really accelerated in the pandemic. And convenience is a great benefit. If you have a CRA who cannot travel, it used to be that to progress as a CRA with your career, you had to get on the road. And there was a limited opportunities for remote monitors in that role, but that has changed. And now if a CRA cannot travel, does not want to travel, they can be a remote monitor and grow and progress because that is a key role in the internal study team. I think Microsoft Teams, Zoom, other video conferencing platforms facilitate conversations, facilitate real-time training, review, and that has made the remote monitoring and all the components associated richer. I even remember during COVID, we were able to do facility tours on FaceTime. And that was very interesting. And it accomplished almost the same objective as a real life tour. The technology with remote monitoring, you know, you have centralized monitoring where you're looking at data across data sets and across sites, getting information on trends and outliers, and that information given to the remote monitor in the monitoring makes for a more rich risk-based monitoring assessment. So I think in those aspects, it's very, very positive and beneficial. Some challenges to remote monitoring have been sites that don't have the technology to facilitate it. For example, some sites have electronic source and they give monitors access, login access. Some institutions, a lot of institutions give monitors direct read-only access to the electronic medical record system that is used. That facilitates almost as robust as a data review as being on site, not quite. But if you have sites that are limited, if you have sites that have to get extra staff to perhaps be on a video conferencing platform with a CRA, sharing screens, they're holding up elements of the CRA to review on the video conferencing, and then you have privacy and making sure privacy is maintained. So those factors can be very, very challenging. I think mostly it's positive. It's been around for quite a while, but really was accelerated during COVID and like anything, working out the kinks, but it is a very good additional level of review. And I think it's positive.
Okay, good. Okay. Well, continuing on with this whole technology idea, let's talk about some innovations, especially the integration of different digital technologies such as e-source, e-regulatory, EMRs, electronic data collection, into a single access point. That's done much to streamline trial operations. Do these so-called site enablement platforms make the CRA's job easier as well?
I think the premise of one site enablement platform is wonderful for efficiency and cohesion. As CRAs, I'll give you an example. I was once assigned to a study and there were 10 systems, technology platforms supporting the trial. Right. And the passwords were amazing. And I don't mean in a good way. A typical complaint of CRAs is all the passwords. So if you are at a site that has an integrated platform, enablement platform, I imagine less passwords. I imagine systems speaking to each other. I've worked at some sites where their e-source and their e-reg talk to each other. And systems where if you enter data like in an IRT system and it populates data in the EDC system, these systems are more efficient, less time consuming, and that is very beneficial as long as the tech is good. Sometimes that can be a problem. I can't speak to this directly because I've not directly worked with it, but I've heard of it and I've read about it. So the thought in theory, it's a wonderful efficiency, you would think.
You would hope, but it also requires on the staff knowing how to use it properly, doesn't it?
It does. And most site staff are super tech savvy. I've not been to one site, I don't think, where one person there was just so proficient with tech. And you can't work on a clinical trial if you don't have computer savvy to some degree, just as like as a CRA, you can't as well. I mean, it goes hand in hand, especially with technology and AI and all the technology used in our monitoring at the site side and on the CRA side. So it's a must.
Let's talk about one of the biggest troublesome trends for sites in clinical trials these days, the increasingly complex protocols. According to data from the Tufts Center for the Study of Drug Development, the number of endpoints per phase 3 trial has increased 37% over the past decade, and the number of procedures per trial has increased 42%. How has the CRA's site training role changed to accommodate this growing protocol complexity?
I can speak to trends I've seen in training over the past 10 years at different companies where I've worked. I would say a while ago, even beyond 10 years, training was kind of piecemeal that I experienced. Here's a protocol, read the protocol. If we have someone available to train you, that's great. This is beyond 10 years. This is like 15, 20 years ago. And I'm not speaking negatively against any company or any trend. I'm just saying it was less regimented and thorough and robust than it is now. Over the last 10, even 15 years, training has adopted as the complexity of the protocols has increased. Now you have CRAs who receive either live instructor-led training on the protocol or it's recorded. They get therapeutic training by a medical monitor. They get training on the different systems. There's a shared portal or a shared system where you'll find the investigators' brochures, training manuals, study manuals, initiation visit training, which is critical with the protocol design and everything, has become very robust. And not only do you have instructor-led training and system training like in an LMS system, then CRAs are given time and encouraged to really do self-training. Not every company gives the same amount of time. Sometimes CRAs have to make their own time. And there's been many a Saturday I've read a protocol, but the motivated CRA is going to have gotten the training needed to accommodate the complexity of the protocol, and they're going to do self-training as well. So the two combined really help to make a comprehensive understanding to match the complexity. And let me tell you, I've worked on some studies that were very complex compared to 15 years ago, phase 1 oncology studies, some of the COVID studies, and I thought the training was very, very sufficient.
Right. That talks about training of the CRAs and self-training, and that leads me to my next question, which is about the CRA's job prospects in general. In the early days of the pandemic, there was an uptick in hiring and training of CRAs to handle all of the burgeoning COVID-19 trials that were coming along, but that hiring has fallen off somewhat in recent months. And some CRA training programs are on hold, or employers are reluctant to hire new CRAs. What can you tell prospective CRAs about current job prospects and how to highlight their qualifications?
Well, that's a great question, and I'll answer it obviously twofold. The first one is our industry trends, right? Before 2008 and the recession, contract CRA jobs were plentiful. There were more jobs than CRAs. 2008, 2009, contract CRAs were out of work, going to permanent jobs. There was a graveyard on CRA jobs. Then we've seen that trend again. So everything always comes around in clinical research in my experience. And Leslie, I don't know if you agree with that, but I truly mean that. So right now, it seems like you can even see it on LinkedIn. There are layoffs. I can't speak to economic climate. I can just speak to trends in my experience and what I've seen and what I think. I do think the pendulum will swing back around based on need more than anything else to companies being more open to newer CRAs. I would say that new CRAs don't feel discouraged, even if there aren't plentiful CRA training programs. I've asked this question a lot, and I answer it by people saying, how do I break into the CRA role? How do I do this? you might have to step back to move forward. And what that means is you might be a site director. You might have been a physician from another country. But coming here, you might have to take an entry-level job with a sponsor or a CRO and maybe take a pay cut. However, you earn your stripes, you work hard for a company, you voice your interest in becoming ultimately a CRA. Organizations and retention are very, very important because hiring and retraining employees costs a lot of money. Yeah. Working in an entry-level position, voicing your interest to move within the organization, it's a very good opportunity for an entry-level person like a project assistant or a data manager to be able to become trained and move up in an organization as a CRA. That is always a viable option. Transferable skills on a CV. Any work that has been done with a data review, with training, with presenting, with quality assurance. For example, if you're a study coordinator, and a lot of sites employ study coordinators to do their own review of source and data and studies for other studies, because, you know, if a site's going to be audited, if they have internal QA measures, it's going to help their efforts. Study coordinators that have done that type of work, that's a transferable skill. Highlight that on your CV. Anything relevant to the role, highlight on your CV. And I also encourage folks, it might be slower right now, but don't give up. And I know it's easy for me to say, but trust me when I tell you, sometimes you have to put the time and the work in. It will happen. Right now, it might take longer. And then in a year, it might take shorter time. Everything comes around.
Interesting. Do you find that the industry is moving away from this so-called requirement to have about 2 years of experience to be able to advance in a CRA job? Are they more accepting of experience in other areas?
I think during the pandemic and post 1 year or a little bit more, they were. Things are very interesting right now in the clinical research climate that I've seen. So I can't really give you a definitive answer. I can say that it seems like post-pandemic, employers are more open to diverse experience. It's no longer the square box. If you were a CRA or, like I said, a physician from another country and you had a little bit of CRA experience or you had some type of industry experience, that might be more accepted. I've met a couple of new CRAs who were site directors for 15 years and 10 years ago that didn't get them anywhere. And then in the pandemic and post-pandemic, they were more accepted. So it was the trend. At this moment, I'm really not sure because things are a little bit in flux and there's a little bit of a halt or a little bit of a slowing.
Right.
So
tough job market.
That's the answer I can give you.
Okay. Now, I know you're certified CRA.
I am.
What do you think the benefit of certification is? Should people be pursuing a certification like ACRP's certified CRA?
Certification for me was just a way to kind of confirm and validate knowledge that I had acquired and kind of cement, yes, this is correct. Yes, you understand this. No, you don't understand this. I took my certification test and I did okay. I did not do great, but I passed and that's all that matters. I'm not saying that being certified will get you a higher salary or a better job prospect, but it's just one more form of due diligence. And it's one more validation of knowledge, I think. I don't know of employers that will give higher salary or you get a better job prospect if you're certified, but it's just one more step to show credibility, due diligence, continuing education. You made that effort. And there's several good organizations that offer certifications. I think it's a wonderful thing. And I think it's becoming more common to be pursued by clinical research professionals maybe than in latter years.
Okay, that's interesting. Good to know. I want to turn for a minute to the global environment of clinical trials. Clinical trials are being conducted more and more in multiple countries, and that presents a challenge for CRAs in a variety of ways. What can you say about that?
I myself have not monitored in another country. so I can't speak to that. I've worked on global project teams throughout my career. And I don't think it was a challenge inherently at all. I think it's really important to remember that English is a second language for a lot of people. It's very important to remember that with communications. It's very important to be flexible because people are in different time zones and you might have to be on a 6:30 a.m. call to accommodate your friends in South Africa or Spain. Mm-hmm. So just that flexibility and that understanding. I can say that I've had some really interesting experiences where, for example, I was doing pre-study visits in Florida and it was for a study and there was a wonderful site and there was a predominantly Hispanic population in that community, which was wonderful. The staff were bilingual. The physicians were bilingual. That was their primary patient base. But English was the second language for some of the study coordinators. And so I really thought it was important that the CRA that took over that site spoke Spanish because that was the demographic, that was the diverse patient population, and the coordinators would benefit from working with someone who spoke their language, their first language. So that's a unique aspect of the importance of being mindful of the international communities within the U.S., without the U.S. I've never had the opportunity to monitor in another country. Like I said, I wish I could. I don't think Canada counts. So I've monitored in Canada before, which is wonderful, but that doesn't count.
Yeah. So it's language considerations, cultural considerations, time zones, and logistics. Those are the big
yes, in my opinion. Yeah. But again, I can't speak from expertise at all. Yeah, I can just tell you what I've observed.
I know you have several anecdotes in the CRA's Guide to Training, Monitoring, Clinical Research, anecdotes from your career. Maybe share one of those with us.
I do. It's not really a funny story. It's kind of not an alarming story, but it speaks to the importance of really doing a good evaluation visit and picking the right site. It's not funny though. Is that okay?
No, that's fine.
I once went to a site, this is probably 12, 15 years ago. No, it was actually 18 years ago. And it was a dermatology study. And I was just doing a one-off visit. The project needed one monitoring visit because they were short-staffed and they hadn't had a monitoring visit in months. So I was just doing a one-off as a favor to the project team. And two things happened that were two of the most concerning things I've ever seen. Not the most, but two of the most. They had enrolled probably about 15 patients. And I walked into the site and the first thing I noticed was in the lobby. And I literally was walking through the lobby and I had to do a double take because it was so surprising to me. Because the CRAs, you kind of learn to observe everything. Even when you're not trying, you notice little things. They had study drug. No kidding. It was a dermatology study and the drug was the type of ointment for something. And they had study drugs stored, no kidding, in the lobby on shelves with commercial over-the-counter drug, no security, nothing, just out there. And when I said to the study coordinator, and she was new, when I said to the study coordinator, what's going on here? There was no answer. What's wrong? I am not exaggerating. So then the other thing that happened at that site was they had enrolled 15 to 20 patients. And when patients are signing the consent form, the signature requirements are driven by the IRB. It's also institution, but it's primarily the IRB. Right. And so the consent form has a signature page and it can either be signature of the investigator of the person obtaining consent from the patient, or it can be signature of individual obtaining consent. It just depends. So they had consented 15 patients, and on the second to last page of the consent form, the signature requirement was signature of the individual obtaining consent, and then the patient's signature place as well. But then on the last page, there was the requirement for signature and date of the principal investigator. Well, this site had consented 15 patients, and they hadn't even bothered to notice the final page of the consent form. So the PI had not signed any of the consents, and it was one of the signature requirements. So we have a site that enrolled 15 patients, study drug was stored out in the open, willy-nilly with the commercial drug, and they hadn't had the PI, they hadn't followed the informed consent requirements of the IRB that approved the informed consent. So that was the most concerning thing, one of the most concerning things I've ever seen at a site. To
the lesson then being expect the unexpected, look for
lesson then when someone tells you it's going to be really easy, no problem, visit, do not believe. Just kidding. Yeah. Keep your eyes open. Yeah. And you know, adapt. That visit went from, oh, this is going to be easy, to, oh, this is a huge issue, call the project manager, escalate, report to the IRB. I mean, multitude. So
I was thinking of one anecdote that you have in the book about flying somewhere and not being able to get to the site.
I was scheduled to do 2 monitoring visits in 1 week, and this speaks to traveling and how you have the grand plan and it can be waylaid. One visit was in Toronto, and then they had asked me to pick up a visit in Newfoundland, which is one of the, I believe, maritime provinces, which is from California. They're like 4 or 5 hours ahead time zone. To get there took like 10 hours. But since I was already going to be in Toronto, it was only about a 5-hour journey from Toronto. So my travel plans were going from San Diego to Minnesota as the layover to Toronto. I was in Toronto Tuesday, supposed to be in Toronto Tuesday. Then I would fly Wednesday to the outskirts of the earth, Newfoundland. And then I would be in Newfoundland Thursday. And then I would fly home Friday. Great plan. So leave San Diego, get to Minneapolis. Never even got out of Minneapolis until the next day because of weather. So monitoring visit number 1 in Toronto, canceled. They're like, no problem. Still go to Newfoundland. Everything will work out. So Wednesday, stay over in the hotel in Minneapolis. Flew from Minneapolis to, I believe it was still Toronto. And then got to Toronto, cross fingers, got on the flight to Newfoundland. Newfoundland, I found out in the middle of the flight, half the flights don't get there because of the winds. Because it's a small plane. It's like it was a prop plane, you know, where the Flintstones and the birds are flying the plane. I'm just kidding. But so we are 3/4 of the way to Newfoundland. This is Wednesday. And the pilot comes on the plane and says, ladies and gentlemen, due to high winds, we will not be going to Newfoundland. We are rerouting you to Nova Scotia. Awesome. So I was supposed to do 2 very important monitoring visits. Never even got anywhere. We got to Nova Scotia at like 11 o'clock at night. I had to beg, borrow, weep, cajole to get 1 room at a hotel. I was on the phone with Delta for 1.5 hours. I was at the hotel for probably 3 hours, and I turned around and had to catch a 4 a.m. flight to try to get home on Thursday. It was 4 hours to Calgary from Nova Scotia, 4 or 5 hours. Then it was 3-hour layover. And then it was 4 hours from Calgary to Seattle. And then it was 3 hours from Seattle to San Diego, all in about 2 hours of sleep. So that was a fun week.
That would have been a good situation for remote monitoring.
That's like the extreme, but that can happen to CRAs, and you just have to roll with it.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was kind of fun, but we're about out of time. So can you leave us with some encouraging words about the future of the CRA profession?
You know, what's great about the CRA profession is it is a wonderful springboard. So I'll leave kind of 2 thoughts. So new CRAs that are in their job and maybe they're looking for a change or they're wondering about the 5-year plan, there are so many things you can do from the CRA position. I've known CRAs who became project managers, clinical trial managers, CRA managers. I did that, CRA trainers. I've met a couple of VPs of large global CROs who were CRAs. I've met CRAs who became site owners. So that's one word of encouragement. you receive so much training in the CRA job: data analysis, data review, judgment, presentation, facilitator, problem solver, trainer. And those responsibilities and tasks are so transferable to so many roles. I will also leave you with the word of encouragement that as much, there used to be a joke that eventually the robots would replace CRAs. This is a long time ago. And that I don't see that ever happening. Even as AI comes about, even as technology impacts the industry more and more, CRAs are always going to be, in my opinion, an integral part of the drug development cycle. And as the role progresses and changes, which it has, you had 100% source document CRA review traveling, then you had risk-based monitoring, then you had the remote monitor working with the on-site monitor. As the roles change and grow, I believe the CRA role will always be important and vital. And there are just so many opportunities.
Yep. So the future is something to look forward to for CRA.
Absolutely. Great. No matter if you want to stay a CRA or if you want to become VP of a global CRO.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much for talking with me today, Elizabeth. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in. And we hope you found this episode insightful and informative, and that you'll join us for future episodes of WCG Talks Trials. Bye for now.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of WCG Talks Trials. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on your preferred listening platform as we continue to explore different areas of the clinical research industry. As always, we encourage you to join in the conversation. Feel free to reach out to us if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for future topics you'd like to hear on the show by visiting us at wcgclinical.com/podcast. We're here to serve as a trusted resource as we work to improve lives and accelerate clinical research together.